Thank you so much, Rob, for inviting me, and thank you all for participating in the panel, and thank you all for coming. I'm delighted to be here. In his 2009 acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize, President Barack Obama declared, and I'm going to go like this when I quote, "Where force is necessary, we have a moral and strategic interest in binding ourselves to certain rules of conduct. And even as we confront a vicious adversary that abides by no rules, I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war." By the time Obama accepted the Nobel Peace Prize, 1 year into his presidency, he had ordered more drone strikes than George W. Bush had authorized during his two presidential terms. The Bush administration detained and tortured suspected terrorists. The Obama administration has chosen to illegally assassinate them, often with the use of drones. Indeed, Obama has added only one new detainee to the Guantanamo roster. The government has decided that instead of detaining members of Al-Qaeda at Guantanamo, they are going to kill them, according to John Bellinger, who formulated the Bush administration's drone policy. On Terror Tuesdays, Obama and John Brennan, his CIA director, who used to be his counterterrorism advisor, go through the kill list to identify which individuals should be assassinated, generally within the next 60 days. The Obama administration has developed a creative method of counting civilian casualties from the assassinations. All military-age men, basically from 16 to 65, in a drone strike zone are considered to be combatants unless there is explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. Obama orders two different types of drone strikes, personality strikes which target individual suspected terrorists, and signature strikes, which don't target individuals, but target areas of suspicious activity. In the signature strikes, sometimes they're called crowd killings, the administration doesn't even know who they're killing. But, write Joe Becker and Scott Shane of the New York Times, some State Department officials have complained to the White House that the criteria used by the CIA for identifying a terrorist signature were too lax. The joke was that when the CIA sees three guys doing jumping jacks, the agency thinks it's a terrorist training camp. Men loading a truck with fertilizer? Probably bomb makers, but they also might be farmers. Now, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration justify their wars, and we have Iraq and Afghanistan with Bush, and we have the continuation of Afghanistan and some things going on in Iraq as well, but I think Obama is dropping drones in seven different countries now. So they justify their wars with reference to the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or the AUMF, from 2001. And it authorized, Congress authorized the president in this AUMF to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determined planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks of September 11th, or harbored the people who carried them out. This authorization is limited to Al-Qaeda and individuals and groups associated with the 9/11 attacks. Congress specifically rejected the Bush administration's request for open-ended military authority to deter and preempt future acts of terrorism or aggression against the United States. So this AUMF does not cover what Obama's doing now. So Obama went to Congress and said, look, I want a new and improved AUMF. And he came up with a proposed one that you had holes in it so big you could drive a truck through. But nevertheless, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, did not agree to go along with this AUMF, not for any principled reason, but because they don't agree on anything, really, these days. So Obama said, I don't need it anyway. I'm going to use the 2001 AUMF, and that covers it. So he said he wanted a new one, but I don't need it anyway, he said. He has extended his battlefield beyond Iraq and Afghanistan to Pakistan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Syria. These armed drones are flown by pilots located 7,500 miles away from their targets. And before launching their payload, the drone hovers above communities. I think that they can stay up in the air 22 hours. And they terrorize children and other people in the communities who never know when these bombs are going to drop. David Rohde, a New York Times columnist who was kidnapped by the Taliban in Afghanistan in 2008 and later escaped, wrote that the drones were terrifying. From the ground, it is impossible to determine who or what they are tracking as they circle overhead. The buzz of a distant propeller is a constant reminder of imminent death. Drones fire missiles that travel faster than the speed of sound. A drone's victim never hears the missile that kills him. After the drone drops the missile on its target, a second strike often bombs the rescuers who are rescuing the wounded from the first strike. This is called a double tap. But they should also have a description of a triple tap, because then U.S. bombs drone mourners at the funeral for the people who were felled by the first and second taps. Obama's administration has killed many more people with drones than died on 9/11. In fact, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is the premier non-governmental organization out of London that calculates civilian casualties, and they have a chapter in the collection, estimate that about 5,000 people have been killed with drones, at least 1,000 of them civilians. The Council on Foreign Relations reported that the vast majority of these people killed with drones were neither al-Qaeda nor Taliban leaders. Instead, they were low-level, anonymous, suspected militants who were predominantly engaged in insurgent or terrorist operations against their governments rather than in active international terrorist plots. And in fact, the United States government maintains kind of a schizophrenic relationship with the Pakistani government, because when a drone bomb kills lots of people, families, people at weddings, funerals, there's outrage among the population. And so the Pakistani government screams and yells about sovereignty and you're violating our sovereignty. But as long as the U.S. drones the enemies of the Pakistani government, tribal leaders, other low-level people who the government doesn't like, then they give a wink and a nod to the U.S. drone bombs. And that's why there is no real pushback from the Pakistani government. Now, drones are Obama's weapon of choice because, unlike piloted fighter aircraft, they don't jeopardize the lives of U.S. pilots, although they certainly do lead to widespread PTSD among the pilots. In fact, there's so much PTSD that they can't get enough pilots to fly their drones, and so they're offering them bonuses, big bonuses, and doing tremendous recruitment to get people to fly these drones. How many of you saw the movie Good Kill? Two people saw it. You ever heard of Ethan Hawke and January Jones? A-list actors. They star in it. Why do you think it never got into the big theaters? I think it had something to do with the content. It traces the life of a drone pilot who lives in Las Vegas with his family and works at Creech Air Force Base outside, a few miles away, 20 or 30 miles away from Las Vegas. He goes home to his family at night. He puts on his flight suit. He goes in the morning and sits in a trailer with other people and watches on kind of a video game type screen where people are, and you can see, for example, it's fictional, but it's based on historical fiction, I guess you would say. You can see the drone strike zone, and there's a guy, I think he's the bad guy, and they're getting ready to drop the missile, and then there's a 10-second delay between the pushing of the button to drop the missile and the actual dropping of the missile. And in that 10 seconds, a woman and child walk into the drone strike zone. And so the title Good Kill comes from what another person in that trailer, also in the Air Force, says after the pilot drops the missile and it blows up and kills people, and then someone says, good kill, good kill. And that's where the title comes from. So there are claims that the use of drones result in fewer civilian casualties than manned bombers, but a study based on classified military data by the Center for Naval Analyses and the Center for Civilians in Conflict found that the use of drones in Afghanistan has caused 10 times more civilian deaths than manned fighter aircraft. In the United States, the dominant narrative about the use of drones in Pakistan is of a surgically precise and effective tool that makes the U.S. safer by enabling targeted killing of terrorists with minimal downsides or collateral impacts. This narrative is false, according to the comprehensive report Living Under Drones, issued by Stanford Law School and NYU Law School. Many killed by drones are civilians, or in the administration's parlance, bug splat, referring to the collateral damage estimate methodology the U.S. military and the CIA employ. Targeted killing with drones is counterproductive. General Stanley McChrystal, architect of the U.S. counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan, declared that drones are hated on a visceral level and contribute to a perception of American arrogance. Kurt Volker, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, agrees. He said, drone strikes do not solve our terrorist problem. In fact, drone use may prolong it. Even though there is no immediate retaliation, in the long run, the contributions to radicalization through drone use may put more American lives at risk. Mullah Zubara, a southern tribal sheikh from Yemen, told the journalist Jeremy Scahill, the U.S. sees al-Qaeda as terrorism, and we consider the drones terrorism. The drones are flying day and night, frightening women and children, disturbing sleeping people. This is terrorism. Drone strikes breed resentment against the United States and lead to the recruitment of more terrorists. Drones have replaced Guantanamo as the recruiting tool of choice for militants, according to Becker and Shane. They quoted Faisal Shassad, who, while pleading guilty to trying to detonate a bomb in Times Square, told the judge, when the drones hit, they don't see children. Jeremy Scahill writes, the secret war in Pakistan became largely a drone bombing campaign described by CIA officers at the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad as boys with toys. By the end of Obama's first year as president, he and his new counterterrorism team would begin building the infrastructure for a formalized U.S. assassination program, with an aggressive embrace of assassination as a centerpiece of U.S. national security policy. Now, I think that the main reason that I was invited to speak here today as an expert on drones is because I live in San Diego, and that's where we manufacture the killer drones. Not we. But that's where General Atomics Aeronauticals is based, in San Diego. They manufacture the Predator and Reaper drones. The Predators cost about $4.5 million each, the Reaper about $15 million. Now, Tom Dispatch has identified 60 bases used in U.S. drone operations, although there could be more because there's this cloak of secrecy surrounding our drone warfare program. The drone industry doesn't like to refer to their killer robots as drones. It's got a negative connotation, droning above communities. So they call them unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs. And a cute story is, you see this, see the cover here? When you write a book, You have a page on Amazon, and people can write reviews. In fact, if any of you read the book and like it, you can write a little review. You can write it if you don't like it as well. So the book had five stars because of the reviews. And all of a sudden, I noticed it had gone down to like 3.5, and I noticed four reviews that had one star each. And I looked at those four reviews, and they all were employees of Northrop Grumman. And the first guy who wrote, and the others kind of piled on, the first guy who wrote said, "How can you believe a word," he clearly hadn't read the book, "you can't believe a word she says in that book because this is a Global Hawk on the front cover," and he knows because Northrop Grumman manufactures Global Hawks, "and that's not a killer drone. It's a surveillance drone." So I wrote back and I said, "You know, the book is also about surveillance drones, not just about killer drones." And he said, "Well, the Global," writes back, we have this little repartee, he says, well, "the Global Hawk is not a drone. It's a UAV. It's not a drone." So I found a Columbia professor who did a long scholarly article about Global Hawks, called them drones several times, and that kind of ended the conversation at that point. But they don't like to be called drones. They don't like them to be called drones. Now, how many of you have heard of a concept called American exceptionalism? You know what it is. Yes, yes. It's this notion that somehow Americans are better than everyone else. And you often hear Obama at the end of his State of the Union address or when he addresses the General Assembly or, "God bless America." Nobody else but America. America is exceptional. Hillary Clinton uses this word. And we're the leader, and we have to lead the world. And that's really kind of the mentality, make America great again, and to hell with everybody else. Time columnist Joe Klein, who is thought by many people to be a liberal, bought into this whole concept of American exceptionalism in a very disturbing way in 2012 in an interview with Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe. Scarborough said, "You have four-year-old girls being blown to bits because we have a policy that says, you know what, instead of trying to go in, take the risk, get the terrorists out of hiding, we're just going to blow up everyone around them. And he mentioned collateral damage. Joe Klein responded, "The bottom line in the end is, whose four-year-old gets killed? What we're doing is limiting the possibility that four-year-olds here are going to get killed by indiscriminate acts of terror. So it's preferable that foreign little girls get killed," basically, is what he's saying. American exceptionalism also reared its head after the 2013 leak of a 2011 Department of Justice white paper that contained guidelines for the targeted killing of U.S. citizens. There had been very little opposition to the killing of foreigners, people who were not American citizens, with drones. One of the main reasons being we don't hear about it, we don't read about it, we don't see the images of the children whose limbs are spewed around. We don't hear the stories of the victims. We read in the New York Times there was a drone bomb that killed four militants. What's a militant? Anybody know what I mean? I feel very militant about certain things. Militant, what does that mean? So we really don't hear about that. But when people heard that Americans might be killed, all hell broke loose. Rand Paul mounted a 13-hour filibuster to John Brennan's nomination as CIA director. And it's this double standard that caused Nobel Peace Prize winner Archbishop Desmond Tutu to write a letter to the editor of the New York Times in which he said, "Do the United States and its people really want to tell those of us who live in the rest of the world that our lives are not of the same value as yours? That President Obama can sign off on a decision to kill us with less worry about judicial scrutiny than if the target is an American? Would your Supreme Court really want to tell humankind that we, like the slave Dred Scott in the 19th century, are not as human as you are? I cannot believe it. I used to say of apartheid that it dehumanized its perpetrators as much, if not more, than its victims. Your response as a society to Osama bin Laden and his followers threatens to undermine your moral standards and your humanity. Well, when I read that letter to the editor, I thought to myself, I want Archbishop Tutu to write the preface, to write the foreword, rather, to this book. And he agreed, and he elaborates on that whole concept of American exceptionalism in his foreword. In 2013, as international criticism targeted Obama's drone policy and the continued indefinite detention of men at Guantanamo who were starving themselves to death and then being force-fed, which amounts to torture, the president delivered a speech at the National Defense University. He explained that the United States is at war with al-Qaeda and the Taliban and their associated forces, without defining associated forces. Now, while the presidential policy guidance that has the actual guidelines for targeted killing remains classified, while Obama was giving his speech at the National Defense University, the administration released a fact sheet, and that fact sheet summarized certain preconditions for the use of lethal force. I'm just going to tell you briefly what they are. First, there must be a legal basis for the use of lethal force, but it doesn't define whether legal basis means complying with ratified treaties. When the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. Treaties shall be the supreme law of the land. And these ratified treaties by the U.S. government, include the U.N. Charter, which mandates the peaceful resolution of disputes and prohibits the use of military force against any country except in self-defense or when sanctioned by the Security Council, the Geneva Conventions, which prohibit the targeting of civilians, and another one we've ratified, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which protects due process and the right to life. Second, the target must pose a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. Now, continuing and imminent are not defined, but that leaked U.S. Department of Justice white paper says that a U.S. citizen can be killed even where there is no clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future. So you wonder what imminent means. And presumably, the administration sets an even lower bar for non-citizens. Then there must be near certainty that the terrorist target is present. Now, how can you have near certainty that the terrorist target is present if there is no terrorist target? Because you're mounting a signature strike, which is a crowd killing, which is killing all men of military age in a certain area of suspicious activity. There must be near certainty that non-combatants will not be killed or injured. But again, non-combatants are defined as all men of military age in a strike zone, unless there's intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. There must be an assessment that capture is not feasible at the time of the operation. Now, it's not clear what feasibility means, but as you read further, it looks like infeasible means inconvenient. And it was feasible to capture Osama bin Laden. I don't like to use the word capture because animals are captured. Apprehend Osama bin Laden because he was not armed and bring him to trial instead of burying him at the bottom of the ocean. So people say, well, he was a horrible terrorist. Look what he did on 9/11. He deserved it. Why do you have to mess around with due process? And I respond that after World War II, the victorious powers were trying to figure out what to do with the Nazi leaders. And Winston Churchill said, just line them up and shoot them. And to his credit, Justice Robert Jackson, U.S. Supreme Court Justice, who took a leave to serve as the chief U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg, said, no, if we don't provide due process even for the Nazis, we will be passing a poison chalice to future generations. And my feeling is, if it's good enough for the Nazis, who were convicted of war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, and the crime of aggression, then due process should have been good enough for Osama bin Laden as well. Then There must be an assessment that relevant governmental authorities in the country where action is contemplated cannot or will not effectively address the threat to U.S. persons. It's left undefined. And there must be an assessment that no other reasonable alternatives exist to address the threat to U.S. persons, also undefined. But the fact sheet would excuse those preconditions when the president takes action in extraordinary circumstances, which are both lawful and necessary to protect the United States or its allies. No definition of extraordinary circumstances. Now, Obama's claim of vast executive power, basically to serve as judge, jury, and executioner, to kill anyone he wants with no judicial involvement, is precisely what the founding fathers feared when they wrote three co-equal branches of government into the Constitution to check and balance each other. Another disturbing issue here is that the unlawful precedent that the United States is setting with its use of killer drones and other forms of targeted killing not only undermines the rule of law, is not only immoral, but it will also prevent the United States from reasonably objecting when other countries that obtain drone technology develop their kill lists. And the United States is selling killer drone technology to our allies. And you know, our allies this year, they're allies, next year they're terrorists. It's very, very frightening. How many of you have heard of the new whistleblower that worked in the intelligence community, is anonymous, but basically revealed what are now known as the drone papers to The Intercept? Some of you have, yeah. He or she provided documents that reveal this kill chain, in other words, the chain that decides who gets killed. And the source, and I call him a source because the reason that this person remains anonymous is because of Obama's vigorous prosecution of whistleblowers. He has actually gone against more whistleblowers during his administration than all prior administrations together. So this source says, talks about this kill chain deciding who to kill, this outrageous explosion of watch listing, of monitoring people and racking and stacking them on lists, assigning them numbers, assigning them baseball cards, assigning them death sentences without notice on a worldwide battlefield, it was, from the very first instance, wrong. Now, these secret documents demonstrate that the administration kills innumerable civilians in reliance on what is called signals intelligence in undeclared war zones. In other words, they follow cell phones that they think belong to the bad guys, and then they drop the drone bomb or they kill with other means the person carrying that cell phone. Now, somebody might have a cell phone and loan it to his mother or his brother or his sister. So this is not an accurate method of targeting. But the documents show that more than half of the intelligence used to locate potential targets in Somalia and Yemen was based on this method. The source says it isn't a surefire method. You're relying on the fact that you have all these powerful machines capable of collecting extraordinary amounts of data and intelligence, which can cause those involved to think they possess godlike powers. And he says it's stunning, the number of instances where selectors are misattributed to certain people. And he characterized a missile fired at a target in a group of people as a leap of faith. Obama's preference for killing instead of apprehension, and this is what the drone papers show, actually prevents the administration from gathering future intelligence. Because if you kill someone as opposed to interrogating them, you're gonna lose out on a lot of important intelligence. Obama said in 2013, America does not take strikes when we have the ability to capture individual terrorists. Our preference is always to detain, interrogate, and prosecute. But Michael Flynn, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, told The Intercept, we don't capture people anymore. The kill operations significantly reduced the intelligence available from detainees and this task force that is cited, the reconnaissance task force that's cited in these drone papers, recommend capture and interrogation rather than killing in drone strikes. But the American public is largely unaware of the high number of civilian casualties from drone strikes. A study conducted by American University professor Jeff Bachman concluded that both the New York Times and the Washington Post substantially underrepresented the number of civilians killed in drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen, failed to correct the public record when evidence emerged that their reporting was wrong, and ignored the importance of international law. Gregory McNeil, an expert on national security and drones at Pepperdine Law School, wrote that in Afghanistan and Iraq, when collateral damage, that is civilian casualties, did occur, 70% of the time it was attributed to failed, that is mistaken, identification. Anyone caught in the vicinity is guilty by association, according to the drone source. If a drone attack kills more than one person, there's no guarantee that those persons deserve their fate. So it's a phenomenal gamble. Now, as I said, drones are Obama's weapon of choice because they don't result in U.S. casualties. But Dennis Blair, former director of national intelligence, said of these drone strikes, "It is the politically advantageous thing to do. Low cost, no U.S. casualties, gives the appearance of toughness." In February of this year, the bipartisan Stimson Task Force on Drone Policy gave the Obama administration an F, that's F as in Frank, in three areas that the task force had flagged for improvement in its June 2014 report. First, progress in releasing information on drone strikes. Second, explaining the legal basis under U.S. and international law for the drone strikes. And third, developing a more robust oversight and accountability mechanism for targeted strikes outside of traditional battlefields. Now, regarding the first area about releasing information, Stimson concluded that the administration has made almost no information public about the approximate number, location, or death tolls of lethal drone attacks, which agency is responsible for what strikes, the organizational affiliation of people known to have been killed by strikes, and the number and identities of civilians who are known to be killed. In March of this year, the news broke that U.S. drones had killed 150 people in Somalia. And just coincidentally, Obama announced that he is going to make public the number of civilians that have been killed. That was in March. We still have not heard from him, and we haven't heard all of these other things. Just the numbers themselves will be revealing, assuming that they're not lying the way John Brennan did when he said that no civilians had been killed by drone strikes in the year 2011, which was a bald-faced lie, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and other organizations that calculate civilian casualties from drones. Second, Stimson criticized the administration for not explaining the legal basis for the drone strikes. And Stimson mentioned that a few official government documents have been made public that relate to this program primarily through court orders, Freedom of Information Act requests. One was a redacted, that means edited with big black letters, big black lines crossing it out, a redacted memo from the Department of Justice about the legality of the 2011 targeted killing of U.S. citizen Anwar Awlaki without due process of law after the ACLU, New York Times, requested this information under the Freedom of Information Act. The only other released document was the Department of Defense's Law of War Manual with three short sections on the use of remotely piloted aircraft, and the only qualifications that it had were that they can't be inherently indiscriminate or calculated to cause superfluous injury. Now, one of the contributions in the anthology is by Pardis Cabraye, who is a lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who brought the first lawsuit against the Obama administration for this kill list on which Anwar Awlaki, a U.S. citizen's name, appeared. And they sued on behalf of Anwar Awlaki's father, saying that he shouldn't be on this kill list. This was before he was killed. And the Obama administration convinced the judge that Awolaki's father didn't have standing to bring this lawsuit because because his son hadn't been killed yet. So basically the court said, wait till he's killed, then come and talk to us, then you will have standing, then you will have shown harm. And then the third area, oversight and accountability. Stimson said that the administration continues to oppose the release of any public information on the drone program, which has obstructed oversight and accountability. And the Stimson finally noted that the administration has, as a rule, been reluctant to publicly acknowledge the use of lethal force by unmanned aerial vehicles in foreign countries, with one notable exception, and that is after two Western civilians were killed by Al-Qaeda, were held by Al-Qaeda and killed in a U.S. drone strike in January 2015, the administration admitted the deaths but didn't release any details. But that was two Westerners who were killed, so they admitted it. Former CIA Director Michael Hayden mounted a full-throated defense of the U.S. drone program in the New York Times in February of this year, claiming the targeted killing program has been the most precise and effective application of firepower in the history of armed conflict, annihilating the ranks of Al-Qaeda. But how can you verify his claims without any kind of documentation? It's impossible. Hayden also said, we kill people based on metadata. You know what metadata is? This is what Edward Snowden told us, that the NSA, the National Security Agency, collects metadata on all of our communications, all the websites we visit, all the phone calls we make, all the emails we send. They say they don't read the contents of it. But you can tell a lot by looking at patterns of which websites people visit, etc. So Hayden said, we kill people based on metadata, and NSA works together with the Obama administration in the targeting. But Ars Technica recently revealed that the NSA's Skynet program, which uses an algorithm to gather metadata in order to identify and target terrorist suspects in Pakistan, Somalia, and Afghanistan, would result in 99,000 false positives. 99,000 false positives. Now, when we hear about the beheading of a person by ISIS, we are justifiably outraged and sickened and furious. But we don't hear, we don't see people blown up by drones. And the only essay in the book that's reprinted from elsewhere is by Jane Mayer. It appeared in The New Yorker. It's called The Predator War, and it was the first comprehensive study of the drone program. And in 2009, Jane Mayer interviewed a woman named Vicki Duvall. And Vicki Duvall was a former CIA lawyer who now teaches at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. And this is what Vicki Duvall said in 2009. People are a lot more comfortable with a predator drone strike that kills many people than with a throat slitting that kills one. And that's really what we're seeing today. Now, before I conclude, I just want to briefly tell you about the book. It's an interdisciplinary collection, human rights and political activists, policy analysts, lawyers, legal scholars, a philosopher, a journalist, and a sociologist who examine different aspects of the U.S. targeted killing program. And they explore the legality, morality, and geopolitical considerations and evaluate the impact on relations between the United States and the countries affected by targeted killings. The book includes the documentation. Well, let me be a little more specific. I write chapter one, which is the introduction. Richard Falk, I understand, has been here, international legal scholar. His chapter is provocatively called Why Drones Are More Dangerous Than Nuclear Weapons. And you probably think, what is that? He says that nuclear weapons, and this is true, have not been used since 1945 except for deterrence and coercive diplomacy, but drones are unconstrained by any system of regulation. And that's why he says they're more dangerous. The next chapter is by Phyllis Bennis, I think she's been here as well, policy analyst, who describes assassination as central to the U.S. war strategy due to the militarization of our foreign policy. And she details how the war strategy has shifted from counterinsurgency with large numbers of U.S. troops to counterterrorism and targeted killing using drones as the preferred weapons. Then Jane Mayer and Tom Reifer, who is a sociology professor at USD, who examines America's embrace of a global assassination program using JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, and the CIA, which he calls a paramilitary arm of the president. And he also concentrates on the effects of the drones on the pilots themselves. Medea Benjamin, you know who she is, political activist, co-founder of Code Pink. You will see Medea whenever there is a congressional hearing on torture or drones, or President Obama is giving a speech and she's peppering him with questions and being dragged away by marshals. She's fearless. She went to Pakistan and Yemen and interviewed many of the families of the victims, and she talks about the effect of these drone strikes on communities and humanizes the victims. Then the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Jean Meyer, who is a human rights lawyer, talks about the illegality of extrajudicial killing off the battlefield. A philosopher, Harry Vanderlinden, talks about just war theory. Jus ad bellum, which is justice in resort to war. Is it a lawful war? Does it violate the UN Charter? And jus in bello, which is justice in the execution of war, the laws of war. The Geneva Conventions. And he talks about the concepts of proportionality and distinction, where the use of military force has to be proportional to the military advantage sought. And distinction means that there always must be distinctions made between civilians and combatants. And then Pardis Cabraye from Center for Constitutional Rights writing about the Awlaki case. Then an Israeli, Ishai Mnuchin, who is the executive director of PCADI, the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, contrasts the discourse in Israel about the elimination of terrorists and preemptive action with the Palestinian discourse of what he calls day-to-day acts of Israeli state terror and repression. And he examines assassination petitions filed in the Israeli High Court, including the targeted killing case, which PCADI brought. Then legal scholar John Quigley talks about the blowback from drones, the impact of this policy on relations between the United States and the countries in which the affected populations are located in the context of a history of resentment against U.S. interventions and interference. Jay Stanley from the ACLU brings the whole issue home with surveillance drones in America. And he talks about privacy concerns, the First Amendment right to photography versus serious privacy concerns. And there have now been guidelines issued by the Obama administration for the use of drones within the country. By the way, law enforcement is using drones for surveillance, for racial profiling. They're not just used in other countries. I mean, there's surveillance drones used in other countries as well as the killer drones, but there are a lot of drones being used here by law enforcement, and I guess eventually Amazon will be delivering their packages by drones and putting people out of work. And then finally, the last chapter is written by Tom Hayden, who places the advent of the drone age into a historical context of U.S. military invasions and occupations. And he discusses the political and strategic considerations, advocating a transparent set of policies in the use of drones while protecting democracy. Now, drones and targeted killing will not solve the problem of terrorism. If you use the drone in the selected killings and do nothing on the other side, then you get rid of individuals. But the root causes are still there, according to former Somali Foreign Minister Ismail Mahmoud Houri. The root causes are not security. The root causes are political and economic. A Pentagon study conducted during the Bush administration concluded, Muslims do not hate our freedom, but rather they hate our policies. It identified American, this is the Pentagon under Bush, American direct intervention in the Muslim world through the U.S.'s one-sided support in favor of Israel, support for Islamic tyrannical regimes in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and primarily the American occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. He said, although these policies are rationalized to stop terrorism, the Pentagon said, they paradoxically elevate the stature of and support for Islamic radicals. Now, the New York Times, Becker, and Shane sounded an alarm about the ramifications of drone strikes on the future of U.S. relations with Muslim countries. They noted, Obama's focus on strikes has made it impossible to forge, for now, the new relationship with the Muslim world that he had envisioned. Both Pakistan and Yemen are arguably, and I would say definitely, less stable and more hostile to the United States than when Mr. Obama became president. Justly or not, drones have become a provocative symbol of American power running roughshod over national sovereignty and killing innocents. We ignore this admonition at our peril. Until we stop invading countries with Muslim populations, occupying their lands, torturing their people, killing them with drones, and uncritically supporting countries that illegally occupy other people's lands, we will never be safe from terrorism. Thank you.